Welcome back to another episode of Our Interesting Times. It's my pleasure to have Andy Nowicki back on the show. Andy, of course, is a writer and author of several books, including The Columbine Pilgrim, Meta Pizzagate, and Conspiracy, Compliance, Control, and Defiance. His website. You're still the alt-right novelist, right?
Actually, that's not really operational anymore, but
You have a
I can be
Substack page.
found at my Substack. Yes, my Substack page, andynowicki.substack.com. That's a place where you can find me. And I also have a Amazon author page. I know Amazon is the man. We want to stay away from the man, but they've actually they've actually got a good collection of my stuff there. So
Okay,
I'll
so I'll provide the link to the Substack page. So,
yeah, that'd be great.
well, Andy, how you doing? Andy, you there?
I'm here.
How you doing?
I'm good. Did you say something a minute
Yeah,
ago?
there was a pause there. So,
Oh, sorry.
I was looking at several of your articles on the Substack page, several of your postings there, and you past few months you've covered a wide variety of topics. I kind of think they're all related. So, at first glance, to talk about them all, we may come across as being a little schizophrenic. I don't think that's the case.
Yeah, I'm glad you don't think I'm schizo, but I have some detractors who do, but that's just one of the hazards of the job of being a conspiracy realist these days.
So what do you make of the current crisis or situation in America today?
There's so many places I don't know where to begin.
Want to start with political? What's going on with Donald Trump?
Well,
Have you been
obviously,
following that at all? He's been indicted a few
yes.
times.
I mean, I'm aware that I'm aware of that he's run into a lot of legal trouble, for likely. I mean, I haven't looked closely at the cases, but I'm suspecting that they're largely to dare a possible pun here, trumped up.
Yeah, you don't bother the details, the cases. Yeah, they're all BS. At least the
Right.
ones that have been brought. I think any sitting president can be brought up on legitimate charges,
Yeah.
or any
Yeah.
former president, really. But as far as the ones they decide to go after Trump on, yeah, they're pretty much bogus. I mean, a RICO statute they're throwing the RICO at him for questioning an election. So I thought that was funny.
Well, yeah. I mean, obviously they're just throwing everything at him to try, obviously they're desperate to keep him out. I mean, I don't know why have they not resorted to just the old-fashioned Kennedy way yet.
Oh, that. I think they decided, like after Kennedy, they didn't want to do that. It's too messy, so they decided to go this route. That's what they did with Nixon, I guess, the whole Watergate thing, and they set him up for Watergate, and
Right.
that's how you get rid of him. And this isn't an endorse. Again, when you make these observations about a president being removed, it isn't an endorsement of his presidency or his politics or his character. I mean, I didn't vote for Trump in 2016. But
Right.
it's one of these things where, again, to point out sort of the abuse of power that these prosecutors are guilty of at the state and federal level, going all the way up to Merrick Garland, is it isn't to endorse Trump. It's to point out just the simple fact that they're abusing their offices for political reasons, which is pretty clear at this point.
Right. And I mean there's so many different, I mean you ask what's going on with this country. I mean there's so many different ways things we could one could talk about, but I guess that if we wanted to look for a segue into some of those articles that you read, I'm somewhat intrigued, somewhat fascinated by the kind of connections that the, for lack of a better word, deep state, the American deep state seems to have with Ukraine. And This was pointed out. This has been pointed out by many people since, ever since for every time there's been a natural disaster and the federal or state response has been lackluster, to say the least. Like what happened in East Palestine with the train dumping the toxic fumes everywhere. That's almost been forgotten now. Isn't that amazing? That was a few months ago that that happened, and it was earlier this year, wasn't it?
Yes, it was was it in February or March?
Sounds like
Yeah.
something like that. But now with all of the crazy reports out of Maui and these wildfires that were metal was burning, but trees were not burning, and they didn't activate the alarm system, and the police came and stopped people from being able to leave, and just all of the stories that you're hearing about the way the situation was handled that just suggests that something is way, way off there. And Biden wants to give every household who is affected, give each of them $700. And people were saying, well, that doesn't, like, compared to the billions that are going to Ukraine now, that's a pretty paltry sum. Like, the something happens to a disaster, or perhaps a natural disaster, perhaps not, happens to a state of the union, a part of the happens to citizens of the United States, and the response is not nearly as there's not nearly as urgent a response as there has been to Russia invading Ukraine, invading Eastern Ukraine, and the billions and billions of dollars that have been poured into it.
Yeah, I think why the Maui fires are burning, additional $24 billion in aid went to Ukraine.
Yeah. I mean, it's crazy. They're not even, like, they went and they asked Biden if he had any comment on what was happening, the wildfire, and the about the tragedy in Maui, and all he had to do was say something like, "It's a terrible thing, and our thoughts and prayers go out to them, and we're going to take care. We're going to take. There's been a lot of people that are hurt, and we're going to take care of them." All he had to do was say some BS like that, and that would have been fine. But instead, he said no comment. Did you see that? Just like,
Yeah,
no comment.
well, it's kind of tough to be kind of just come up with those remarks off the cuff. Although you just did
I just did it. Make me president. I can handle
You know, you think a polished politician would, of course, think, and I don't think Biden's ever been a polished politician. He's always been kind of a dolt, but
Yes.
now he's in, advanced senility at this point,
Yeah.
you know.
Yeah, true. It's just not a good look. So I mean, it just seems like it's just getting more and more obvious the state of
Well,
play.
not as if Hawaii is going to go red next time, right? So why bother helping? It's
Well,
the problem of living in a solidly democratic state is you don't get any attention.
yeah, you think they would be nicer to the people who voted for them, though,
Have to be
like,
a purple state, a swing state, and the money
yeah,
pours into it.
you think that they would just be mean to the reds, to people in red states,
Yeah.
and leave the people in blue. But California's getting it pretty bad, and now Hawaii is getting it pretty bad, and Oregon's in terrible shape, and it seems like. But yet they're still gonna. Sorry, I don't know what happened there.
He's just back there. Yeah, did you when did you get cut off?
The last thing I said was about all the blue states getting it really bad.
Oh, okay. Yeah, and it's one of those things where it's like Hawaii. And you don't know to what a point is this is just a consequence of diversity and incompetence or malevolence.
Right.
The you saw did you see that video of the water? I guess it was the resource management guy talking about how Hawaiians, indigenous Hawaiians, view water. and they take a more holistic approach to water. And they don't want to treat it like a resource. So you have this guy who's invoking all types of, traditional Hawaiian religious beliefs. When he's in charge of managing water, you think you want someone who had engineering experience, doing this. But instead, he's saying Hawaiians have a more holistic appreciation of water. Don't look at it as a resource. Look at it sort of as a life-giving essence of God or something, one of a God. And then you have the guy who was the I guess the emergency management official who resigned supposedly out of health reasons, but he didn't turn the sirens on.
Yeah, that was another thing. They didn't turn the sirens on. Like there's so many like maybe it's just incompetence, but it's just one thing on top of another on top of another. And I mean that was the same this is the same state that a few years ago sent out the that was it a tweet? No, it was like a text to everybody saying North Korea's just launched a nuclear missile at us. This is not a drill.
Yes.
Remember that? Like that was they the like I still have a hard time understanding how that happens. Like I don't know, and maybe you're right, maybe it is just incompetence. But who knows? It's hard to ignore, just like the layers and layers of one thing after another, like seems to have happened in Maui. So anyway, what I was saying before was like the United States just keeps pumping, even though it's not like I don't think it's a popular idea, and there's never been a vote taken on it that I know of. There's never been a should we send billions of dollars of military aid to keep this destructive war going in Ukraine? I don't think anyone has voted. I don't think the people have ever voted on that.
Now, I think what happened was when Russia invaded Ukraine in February of 2022, the Ukraine flag just replaced face masks.
Yes,
It
absolutely.
was it became the new thing, the current thing, and
It was the way to virtue signal,
yeah,
absolutely.
and there wasn't any debate, a rational discussion, just as there wasn't any really rational discussion debate over many of the COVID containment measures, right? And you were shut down. You were against science if you didn't think putting a paper thing over your face was effective or healthy or prevented breathing. The same way, if you questioned the U.S. response to Russia's invasion of Ukraine, if you happened to point out that the I guess almost decade long history of the U.S. provoking Russia, expanding NATO, you were a Putin bot or something, right?
Absolutely. And I've heard my share of insults along those lines. Just for just for opposing intervention, just for being in favor of peace, of being in favor of negotiating a peace settlement so that Ukrainian men don't just go go running into bullets and dying every day. I mean, you'd think that that would be seen as a mercy to the people, like to people who are pro-Ukraine, but instead you're viewed as a bad person for feeling that way. But I mean, I guess my take on Ukraine, is that there's a lot going on there that's really weird and self-contradictory, and that's part of what I wrote about on my one of my stuff Substack articles in one of my Substack articles, I should say. And I think it's the one that's gotten the most views, that has the title, Ukraine is the Deep State, the Deep State is Ukraine. And I was wondering what your assessment was of what I was saying there.
Well, yeah, I mean the sort of the entanglement or intrigues that the U.S. has gotten itself involved in Ukraine. This goes back to the collapse of the Soviet Union, the dissolution of the Warsaw Pact, and actually the breakup of the Soviet Union, because Ukraine, prior to that was part of the Soviet Union. Then it got its independence, because that independence was always going to be somewhat nominal given its geographic location. Ukraine has always been a part of Russia, Russian Empire, and the Black Sea in that area. That's where Yalta was, right? Crimea and all that. But then all of a sudden I see the U.S. claiming that it has some sort of claim, or it should expand NATO as far as Ukraine. Now, Ukraine's not a part of NATO, and there's been talk of that, but certainly they've expanded, you know, eastward since the collapse of the Soviet Union and the end of the Cold War. And absolutely. So you have to look at it that context. And like the same way that Yugoslavia, when it dissolved, sort of was exploited, war was provoked here by the West to break up Yugoslavia, and also then challenge Serbia. And, you know, there was establishing or supporting secession movements, the former Yugoslavian states, with aid and intervention and all types of deep state tactics, black ops, CIA operations. Same thing in Ukraine and Caucasus in the past 20 years in Russia.
Right.
And so Putin got Russia back on its feet, was able to fight back a little bit. So that's what we're seeing now, where Putin is presenting as some sort of obstacle, I think.
Yes.
However flawed he is. But see, he's presenting some sort of obstacle to the global American empire. You know, the gay, as they say.
The global homo.
Global homo empire. We see that because everywhere the American empire expands, you get promotion homosexuality, transgenderism, and all manners of degeneracy and perversion. That's apparently the only thing that matters now. I think it was Anthony Blinken, our esteemed Secretary of State, who says everywhere he goes, particularly when he's like talking to people, representatives from Saudi Arabia, he talks about gay rights. That's the only thing that matters, apparently. So,
yeah.
Now, 2014, Victoria Nuland, who's sure, you know, I think the author of this war, she's part of the Kagan cult. She's married to Robert Kagan, and they control the U.S. State Department and U.S. foreign policy. So you, even Douglas McGregor, he had an interview with Tucker Carlson recently, an hour-long interview talking about Ukraine, and he didn't say it explicitly, but he said you have a group of people who have a ancestral hatred of Russia, and they're prosecuting this war. And obviously, he's talking about Jews in the State Department. That's Victoria Nuland. Mm-hmm. You know, and it goes back to that, I think. And they have control, evidently, of U.S. foreign policy. And that's why they're trying to provoke a war with Russia, at least go brinkmanship with Russia. And they want the U.S. to back Israel against Iran for some reason. And at the very least, U.S. foreign policy has nothing to do with legitimate U.S. Interests or our interests as American citizens. We're sort of cannon fodder for this. You know, if not directly, the Ukrainians are cannon fodder, but obviously the full faith and credit of the U.S. government is being wasted, in the battlefields of Ukraine. How much money we spent, you know?
Yeah. My take on Ukraine is that, or my observation of Ukraine is that there are certain oddities. And these are some of the things that I write about, that I've written about, in my Substack articles on this subject. And one of those oddities is there seems to be this alliance of Jews and Nazis that are in some kind of weird pact, in Ukraine. Mm-hmm. You have, of course, Zelensky, who's Jewish, the president or prime minister, I can't remember what his title is, but the man in charge, and of course a lot of Jewish interests in the area. But then you have groups like Right Sector and Azov Battalion,
mm-hmm.
and I've heard some people say, well, they're not really Nazis; they're just pretending to be Nazis. I don't get that impression, and I. You know, I get the impression that they are the real thing. And you've got, a country that, like, Ukrainian nationalism is tied up in, like having a national holiday for Stefan Bandera. Is that how you say his name? Mm-hmm. Who was a pro-Nazi. He was a Ukrainian who was... who favored the Nazis during the war, because he was opposed to the Soviets, he was valorized or he became a kind of national hero, and he still is today. And like it was like in the teens, it was like after the 2014 coup that they established his birthday as a national holiday. So these things seem to be contradictory, because we would think of Jews and Nazis as not, as being opposed to one another, but there's something deeper going on. And like I commented on this some function that was happening at the Pentagon. You probably saw this, where John Stewart was John Leibowitz is name his birth name is. He was like the MC of this event where they were celebrating various Ukrainian soldiers, and one of the guys was a member of the Azov Battalion, at least one. I think probably more than one. But there was this weird scene where he comes running out, and John Stewart slaps him a high five and says, and yells out his name, like his name was Uhor or something like that. Some Uhor, and it's like so, and this is a guy who has like Nazi tattoos or not like swastikas, but things that in the context of Ukraine, are illustrative of Nazi ideology. And Azov Battalion is very fiercely Nazi in their orientation. So like what's going on there? Do you have any insight into that?
Well, the whole it goes back to Ukrainian history. The whole idea of Ukrainian nationalism is a creation of foreign intervention in the area. I mean, Ukraine itself, I think, means frontier or borderland for Russia. And so Ukraine's or and so I think like under the Ukraine its current geopolitical borders, I think like over half the country, or at least as much as half the country is Russian or Russian speaking.
Exactly. Yes, the eastern half especially.
The western half, which from time to time, from what I understand, the borders have been changing. It's Poland is looking to take, at least one of the ideas is Poland will take a big chunk of it when this conflict is over. So Poland has some sort of intent, perhaps, of expanding or getting back these foreign. I think this is like Galicia or something. These are so the
Really?
borders have been ever changing, but nevertheless, there's a lot of ethnic intermingling and complexity there.
Yes.
But as far as the Nazi thing goes, like I said, the first I think hint of Ukrainian nationalism was promoted by the Germans in World War I in the wake of Brest-Litovsk, when they at the time appeared to have won the war in the east and knocked Russia out. And they wanted to promote a Ukrainian nationalism to distinguish it from Russian influence.
After they sent Lenin back to Russia
Yeah, the
to
SEAL train and that to the Finland
this.
station, and of course for some reason the Americans and British sent Trotsky to Russia too at the same time. It doesn't again doesn't make any sense. Why would London and DC wanting to weaken Russia when Russia was an ally? But that gets into higher upper level intrigue, meta interest of the bankers who I think were looking to take Russia out and destabilize Russia, similar to what we're seeing today, destabilize that with the revolution. And you had the Jewish bankers in New York like Jacob Schiff, who wanted to of course see the Tsar and his family murdered, which eventually happened in July 1918. But the with what we're seeing in Ukraine now is sort of a reverberation of the Second World War, because when the Germans invaded in June 1941, when they entered the Ukraine, they were treated as liberators from the Bolsheviks. Bolsheviks, of course, under Stalin, had committed heinous crimes. Many of these, at least Stalin's executioners in the Ukraine, were Jewish, like Kaganovich, Lazar Kaganovich, which I don't know if the Kagans are related to him, but Kagan is short for, it might be shortened version Kaganovich. So you have these resentments that carry over from the Holodomor in the 1930s. And so when the Germans
Absolutely.
came in, they saw the Germans as liberators, and many Ukrainians would sign up with the SS, the Ukrainian SS battalions, to help the Germans in the war against what they saw as Judeo-Bolshevism. And you mentioned Stefan Banderas. I think the Germans imprisoned him like in 1943 because he was too radical for the Germans.
Yeah,
Then they released him in 45 just to create trouble because they were desperate by 1945. They were losing the war, and it wasn't too long before they surrendered in May. Nevertheless, the Ukrainians see folks like Stefan Banderas as a sort of a figure for Ukrainian nationalism, anti-Bolshevism, which many Ukrainians looked as being anti-Russian. And it really isn't fair because those who were perpetrating much of the crimes in Ukraine in the 1930s weren't necessarily Russian; they were Jewish. But they had formed much of the Cheka, and then and later the NKVD and some of these battalions that went in the Ukraine and starved everyone to death. So what you have is so they identify as Nazis because they were fighting with the Germans against the Russians, the Soviets, who were associated with Russia because of Russia, but this is really Bolshevism, which is largely a Jewish phenomenon, at least to the extent that it was injected into Russia. But nevertheless, the Soviet Union is an ally of the Western powers in World War II, and they eventually win, of course, as they advance. They crush Germany, but you still have this aftermath. And then after the war, because of the Cold War, the United States is now, just like in 1984, East Asia, once ally becomes our enemy. You've always been at war with East Asia. The Soviet Union becomes our adversary, if not, our erstwhile ally becomes our adversary. Because
And that's when Operation Paperclip happens.
paperclip, but then all of a sudden, so the U.S. intelligence, sort of the fledgling U.S. intelligence community, the CIA, formed in 1947, they look at ways they can instrumentalize these people in the Ukraine. And then at the same time, Paperclip, where the former Nazis or scientists people are incorporated into the Western intelligence agencies and also the scientific community like NASA, of course, Wernher von Braun, these things. So this also factors into sort of the narrative of the Second World War, where the Germany, Nazi Germany, National Socialist Germany is demonized. And lately, of course, that narrative is being challenged, which is driving the Jewish community, or at least organized Jewry, crazy, because that narrative is very important to the maintenance and expansion of their power. Basically, I'm talking about the Holocaust narrative, which again isn't as quite as solid as we once thought it was. And now all of a sudden, we have a shifting narrative where something quite different was happening in World War II. Not quite what we thought it was. It's not quite the moral fairy tale that we were told World War II was good versus evil and these things. So we have the term Nazis, right? Nazis, these things. Well, okay. Nevertheless, this is the reality. This is you have these elements within Ukraine that feel this way. They can be mobilized and instrumentalized and weaponized if need be. With the ascendancy, I think the rise and ascendancy of Jewish power in the United States and sort of the takeover of U.S. foreign policy. Jews can be very practical and cynical, and they're now exploiting that to get at Russia. Although Russia's identity, Putin, the identity of Russia, their identity is also fighting National Socialism. So it's very convoluted, but it's all based on narratives. What's the reality here, though? The
That's what
reality
Chris
is
said.
it's all screwed up, and it can be very easily exploited by the powers that be who control the narrative and also have billions of dollars to fund. Partisan activities or revolutionary movements or destabilize governments like they did with the Yanukovych regime in 2014. So you have the conflict of these narratives. So the narrative of the evil Nazis going after Jews, now Jews aligning with Nazis go after Russia, but Russia, then the Soviet Union defeated Nazi Germany. It was they're the ones that really knocked the stuffing out of the Wehrmacht in World War II. But then they became the bad guys after. In many ways, they were the bad guys. But good guys, bad guys. Are there any really good guys in these things? And so then you have the paperclip thing. Why are they working so, they're so happily to accept Nazis and, to incorporate Nazis into the post-war, intelligence and military. And Well, because at that level, they realize a lot of it is just narratives, and they're very cynical and they're willing to exploit the current situation, current feelings and animosities, misgivings, misconceptions to achieve a certain geopolitical objective. That's what we're seeing in the Ukraine today, because now Russia, post-communist Russia, has now, I think, reverted to a sort of conservative role in the world. Basically, it's going against the global American empire, and it's a potential competing bloc to NATO, which should have gone away in 1989, 1991, when the Soviet Union disappeared, but it actually expanded, which was, which was one provocation after another, which gets us to our current crisis with Russia.
Yes,
So that's convoluted, but that's why it's so hard. So I read your article, I understand your frustration. This is kind of why, because it's a lot of competing narratives and confusion there, but it's all being exploited now. There's no moral consistency or logical consistency to it, because it's pure power politics.
So do you think that Azov and Right Sector and those people, do you think that they don't care that a bunch of Jews are like what are,
Could be my enemy. Enemy is my friend. Meaning, the only chance for them, for Ukraine even to be a rump independent state, is for Ukraine to be destroyed. And the only way they do that to get any power is by working with the Zelensky regime, which is Jewish, and working with U.S. with NATO and U.S., which I would argue is now largely Jewish control, at least foreign policy. That at least the State Department is right now as currently configured, because and so they see it as well. This is otherwise. There would be Ukraine would be a vassal of Russia, which I argue geopolitically it should be, looking at a map, looking at sort of a Bismarckian, a sphere of influence type balance of power type thing, which I think is rational and logical, as opposed to a crazy neocon Jewish thing, which is just endless war, endless revolution. Our democracy has to be expanded everywhere the way we interpret it,
Or something, or even something reason. I would see a reasonable solution being, let's have peace talk. Let's, if the United States and the West were sane and not evil and wanted peace and not war, they would say, okay, guys, let's put a stop to this. Let's iron out some kind of deal where Ukraine can still exist, where Ukrainian people, Ukrainian speaking people in the West are more predominant, but the province, the Donbas, the provinces in the East, which are more Russian, let them go their own way. Let them secede if that's what they want to do, and let's stop this war. Let's stop people from dying. I mean, that's.
Yes, but that practical approach, however sensible it is, how logical, how moral it is, then they can't dominate.
Yeah, I mean,
That's the problem. Rather, they'd rather reign in hell than serve in heaven.
they'd rather fight to the last Ukrainian. I mean,
That's how
it's
they view
almost.
it. And look, if you look at it, that might serve some interest, because I think you've looked at like BlackRock recently signed a letter of agreement or intent with the Zelensky regime to rebuild it after the war, because that's presuming a Ukrainian NATO victory, which I don't think is in the offing. But it shows you, of course, BlackRock's Larry Fink, and that's largely, it's again another Jewish-owned hedge fund corporation, looking at they're making money off the war itself, and they're going, and of course, the war it's that's going to destroy a lot of property, drive property values down. They're going to go in and buy it up at a song, and then be paid to rebuild it. Get rich in the process of rebuilding, and perhaps claim it, because they're depopulating Ukraine, which could be a long-term strategy to create this is Khazaria, their traditional homeland of the Ashkenazi Jews who converted. And there could be a strategy sort of like create a second Israel, a second ho Jewish homeland here. This is that Pale of the Settlement area, right? So there could be that ethnic agenda being played out. And of course, all the principal agents involved in provoking this war and prolonging it are Jewish. Then again, I'm guilty of pattern recognition.
Well, you can't do that. That means you're a bad
They're simply
person.
unwilling to, like Nuland and Blinken, they're simply unwilling to negotiate I thought they're diplomats.
Yeah, that's
But they don't negotiate.
the definition of diplomacy, is that you try to work things out.
Yeah, they don't concede Russia has any legitimate, national security interest in the area, as if it's their, and the NATO or the U.S., the West has the sort of the carte blanche or right just to expand wherever it goes, long as it's doing the name of democracy and sodomy,
Yes.
which go hand in hand, I don't know, from what I understand now. So.
Well, and like the reason why I drew the comparison to the deep state, and I kind of use
Did
the
I
term.
explain that the Nazi thing? Well, do you kind of see what I'm getting at there? When he asked,
Yeah, I can sort of I can understand that. It's just like I wonder from, I mean, I see it, for as far as the people who are using the Nazis, like I can see it for them. It's just a cynical thing, just like when the United States uses ISIS, to try to get, to fight against Assad and his regime in Syria. That's a,
Yeah,
even
why
though.
did was Israel were giving aid and comfort to ISIS fighters in Syria?
Yeah,
And
yeah,
that's just known. Why is that? I thought these are jihadists.
yeah.
It's the same way that U.S. they supported Muslim extremists when they were fighting the Red Army in Afghanistan.
Yeah.
Osama bin Laden and his family, and then that kind of morphed into Al Qaeda, which is largely a narrative again. If you look
Yeah.
at the whole idea that Al Qaeda never really existed as we were told it does. Just like those, remember the caves in Afghanistan that Donald Rumsfeld talked about? The drawings of these kind of like Bond villain-like complexes underground.
Yeah,
Remember that like 20 years ago, 21 years ago?
I do remember that,
Those
yeah.
never existed. But that narrative is out there. Think about that narrative is still there. So then, Mujahideen became Al Qaeda.
Yeah.
Then
So
Al
there were no
Qaeda.
caves? There were really weren't any caves there?
No, there were. I mean, there were these. They had these sort of highlight magazine type drawings. The same way that the missile weapons of mass destruction. These are paintings, and they have like almost like. Look, this is what it's like, and you have like Osama bin Laden, sitting in a conference room, or and then you have missiles and arms and trucks going in and out, and so just far more. Again, it was all fantasy, because it turns out the Taliban had nothing to do with Al Qaeda, which supposedly, or we're told, allegedly carried out the 9/11 attacks. But that itself is again another narrative. If you scrutinize it, kind of falls apart.
Yeah,
But the
absolutely.
thing then we said, well, why are we supporting ISIS, which are jihadists in Syria, if they're the ones that carried out the attacks on 9/11? Well, because that original narrative isn't really true, and it serves the current interest in Syria, because Syria is a stable sort of a stable secular state, which Israel doesn't want. They want
Which is
all
a
the
lie,
stable, yeah.
which has ties to Russia, right?
Yeah,
Or
which
at least.
there's that. Yeah, there's Russia, but the last thing that Israel wants is a rational, stable government to compete with. That's why they got rid of like Saddam Hussein. But then again, if you look at Saddam Hussein, and well, why was he a problem? Well, yeah, the Gulf War, 1991, he invades Kuwait. Why does he invade Kuwait? Oh, because of the debt he owes Kuwait, that he incurred during the war that the U.S. goaded him into to fight Iran, to get at Iran for the Iranian hostage thing in 1979. So we subsidized that war. I mean, we kind of aided both sides covertly. One more covertly, like the Iranian side with the weapon shipments. That goes to the hostage crisis, and then it goes to Iran-Contra. So it gets real convoluted. But multiple agendas are being served, and that somehow that winds up with cocaine being flown into, ending up in Los Angeles and crack cocaine, cheap crack cocaine, which Ricky Ross. Turns into crack cocaine, which it's written about in the San Jose Mercury News. These things, the CIA funding, and then they have that level of the agenda. A lot of people making money off that. The whole weapons thing flying in and out of Arkansas, Mena, Arkansas. Weapons, cocaine, but it's all connected. Just see what I mean about being schizophrenic?
Absolutely.
It's like, oh, and this is why Bill Clinton's awarded with the presidency against Bush, by the way, and he's working with Bush. In the 80s, the National Security Council all over North, to because Ar this the Arkansas is the Arkansas armory there, the National Guard, which gets the weapons flown into Nicaragua. Then the cocaine is flown into, yeah, Barry Seal and all that. He didn't look like Tom Cruise, by the way.
No.
he's flying the cocaine into Arkansas, meaning airport, which then funds a lot of the Clinton financial scandals there, like the Arkansas Development Corporation, Hillary Clinton, and all that. And also, I hate to tell you this, there's some allegations. I'm not saying this is true, but I've heard that it was this also helped capitalize Walmart. This is how, so yeah, this meandering conversation around here.
So Walmart was born out of
Partially, I'm allegedly.
crack cocaine, the crack cocaine trade.
Well, the if you ever heard Catherine Austin Fitz talk about this, companies, some corporations are the recipient of cheap capital, and they use that to
Right.
expand. And that could be a company. I'm not saying it is. I don't want to be sued. I'm saying it's a company like Walmart, how it gets big, or how a certain fried chicken. It's not
Yeah.
just, when you Breaking Bad, those writers for Breaking Bad aren't that original. Talk about how Breaking Bad, how Pollos, the chicken place, and how it's part of this.
That's right.
Yeah, it the money being laundered through the chicken franchises
Right.
boosts the stock of the company that owns the company.
Right.
The multinational in Germany, which owns the company, which boosts the earnings to share ratio.
Well, that was meth, not crack,
Meth,
but
but it's the same thing. My point is, the people are writing for Breaking Bad, they're not that original. They're writing about real stuff. It's a limited
Okay.
hangout. But saying this is why it comes across so convoluted. So this is why the U.S. is supporting ISIS in Syria when supposedly we're fighting a global war on terror, right? But it's never quite explained to the American people, who have an attention span,
Of a net.
of a gnat. But then, see, if you have constant crisis, you have a war, you have a pandemic, a
Yeah.
war, never a dull moment. The public can never concentrate on one thing. That's another thing it's war by crisis, so it's constant, never a dull moment, constant crisis, move from one thing to another. And if you had a fourth branch, the fourth estate, a press doing its job, this is really their job, right? Or
Yes.
you have academia doing their job, but they're
Yes.
all in bed with it now, so.
Well, of course, I that's another thing I wrote about was the how the once anti-war left has almost completely disappeared. That was the subject of a more recent
That's right.
with regard to the rise of neoliberalism,
You
and
have Bono
how.
and Sean Penn cheering for
Yeah.
war, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Compare Sean Penn in 2003 to Sean Penn of 2022. In 2000, I mean, he's still a lot. I mean, he's still really unlikable. To me, in both cases, just seems comes across as really arrogant and full of himself. But at least in 2003, he was on the right side. If he was saying, this war in Iraq, this invasion of Iraq is a disaster and it's a humanitarian outrage and so forth. And so were a lot of people on the left in the early aughts. But now it seems as if the mainstream left, the establishment left, has completely bought off the anti-war. Like there's nobody on the left, on the establishment left, who's anti-war anymore. They're all rah-rah, American foreign policy. It used to be like a calling card of the left was to complain about American foreign policy, to complain about or to point out to rightly point out things like the CIA engineering coups in 52 different nations, or interfering in elections and all over the world, and and doing this and doing that, and you know, Kissinger bombing Chile, and you know, at bringing Pinochet, you know, installing Pinochet, and all kinds of activities like that, or the Shah in Iran, and that was like, if you were on the left, like even 15, maybe 15 years ago, you know, yeah, you were into like liberal social issues, and you were probably pro-gay, and you know, feminist and stuff like that. But you were also like, you know, the U.S. has a foreign policy that is criminal. They're doing all, and like that was the moral heft of the left, you know, traditionally speaking. And there were some on the right who were saying those things too, but not the establishment right. You know, but there were like the, I guess, the John Birch Society and you know, others of like not non-affiliated, who weren't affiliated with the Cold War mentality, like just sort of the isolationist right, who weren't who didn't who also were against all these things happening. But it was mostly the mainstay of the left. It was like, but today it's like the left has, or the establishment left, you know, anybody who's affiliated with the Democrat Party, they're I can't think of a single, I mean, not that I'm a political scholar, that I, you know, examine, that I can, this is more just a general, my noticing a general trend amongst the Democrats in power. None of them say bad things about American foreign policy anymore. None of them badmouth the CIA anymore. It's really quite an amazing, you know, transformation that's taken place. Like, even back in like the late aughts and the early, I guess the early tens, you know, the left was praising Julian Assange for exposing war crime, you know, Americans who committed war crimes in Iraq, and you know, they were heaping praise upon Assange, and then Assange turned against Hillary Clinton, and they all, you know, and pointed out how evil, what an evil warmonger Hillary Clinton was, and then after that, they just all turned their backs on him. Didn't am I mistaken?
Yeah, there appears to be a purge that occurred right around Iraqi invasion of Iraq in 2003. That's when,
Mm.
like, Phil Donahue was kicked off MSNBC.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's
That occurred, and then you had Barack Obama become president in 2009, and
right.
so then he couldn't. It's okay if he bombs people,
Yeah,
kills people with drones,
it's
and
okay if he drone strikes people.
even
Yeah.
American citizens, right? Two American citizens, from what I understand.
Yeah.
And so,
And like they buy them off by wokeifying, you know, the all of these evil agents, like all the evil alphabet agencies who are engaged in all the skullduggery and
you give them sodomy and
yeah,
gay
you say, oh,
marriage, and yeah.
we're pro-gay and we're pro-trans and we're flying the gay fl we're flying the LGBT flag now at CIA headquarters, and here's an ad geared to, you know, say, like they put out an ad for you know, a show having some lesbian talking about her about joining the CIA and becoming a drone pilot.
Yeah.
And it's like, hey, we're still murdering people all over the world, but now we're woke, so you can't be against us anymore. I mean, it seems like something like that happened. Like there was that, and that's
Was
part
it
of
well that one ad said, I'm a Latinx with obsessive compulsive disorder, and I'm with CIA or something. I was
yeah.
like, what the hell?
Like so pandering and ridiculous. I mean, I don't know. I don't know if anybody actually took it seriously, but I guess some people must have, or an order, a decree has gone out in any case, like.
Yeah, they've been purged. There's no more serious journalism, even journalism that's posing as serious. I don't think
Yeah.
journalism is never free in this country because it's always controlled by money powers. Newspapers are expensive, businesses are radio, so it's never news. But there seemed to be at least some diversity and some real journalism in the 70s, even the 80s, into the 90s, even the early aughts. You had some good stuff. But yeah, look at Seymour Hersh. He's relegated to Substack. This is a New York Times.
Seymour Hersh, who owns the Miley Massacre.
Yes.
I mean, a legendary journalist, and like well respected, and tons of integrity, and he's on the outs. Like he's a lone voice crying out in the wilderness when obviously the CIA sabotages the what was it, the Nord Stream pipeline. He's the only one saying, yeah, they did it. Like, it's just, that was amazing to me that they were. I don't think I've written about this, but I've probably recorded a couple of videos on this subject, but that they were able to just do that and then just not talk about it. And then, oh well, I guess that happened. No, and none, and nobody called them out. Nobody said, this is basically an attack on Germany, isn't it? I mean, isn't it essentially
Well, basically, you had you
attack on an ally?
essentially the U.S. attacked a fellow NATO member,
Right.
which I don't know if there is a clause in that. What happens when a fellow NATO member attacks another NATO member? Is that a is there a declaration of war? Or does the alliance dissolve?
Don't
But apparently,
know.
if you question that in Germany, and you're a member of the Alliance for Germany, the alternative party, alternative for Germany. In the name of democracy, they're going to ban you if the party gets too popular. If you're not popular, if you're in single digits, they won't bother with you. But if you get popular, that's when they have to ban you to save their democracy, as way that we have ways that we save our democracy here by the FBI shutting down debate on social media and deplatforming people and suppressing stories. That's how you
Saying
defend democracy.
it's disinformation and
Yes.
so forth. Were people not pissed off in Germany about that? I never heard. I'm sure some people were. I know there have been demonstrations
Well, you can, yeah,
in.
you're pissed off, but if you demonstrate or you mobilize politically, or at least effectively in a political manner, then you're in trouble politically. So they'll burn over books you have they don't like, and then they'll put you in jail. I might give you a heart, like that. What was that reporter? Worked for the Frankfurt Allgemeine, or you call it a German name, but he's one that. Uter Ulterkopf, I think is his name. He claimed that CIA controlled the newspapers, and next year he died of a heart attack or something.
Oh, I don't know his story. I'll
Yeah,
have to
he
look it
came
up.
out and said the CIA would tell him what to publish, and he'd publish for him, and that's what most journalists do in Germany. And so probably not much different in other Western countries, even the United States. And it's not just, again, it's not the Langley giving out orders. It's people know what's acceptable. The CIA represents the globe, the oligarchic financial interests, which control the newspapers and the media. So it's all coordinated. And we know since the 70s, at least with Operation Mockingbird, that the CIA had directly, I think, recruited 400 journalists and editors, and they pretty much controlled or were able to manipulate the news in a way that CIA thought was congenial to its interest or the interest of the parties that it was an agent for. And that's, again, if you think about it, not too surprised by that, because even before the CIA was created, for that type of untoward relationship was consummated in 1947, you had a time with big media and news and capital, and they controlled government, and they were able to manipulate the news cycle in the lead up to World War II. They certainly did it in the lead up to World War I. I think it was in 1917, Oscar Galloway, he was a congressman from Texas who gave a speech on in the Congress, how a handful of financiers had bought up all the major newspapers to control the news flow to guarantee America's entry into World War I. And
And
the
then who's
following year,
a
he was defeated in an election. He
okay. Okay, well.
retired from politics after giving that speech. Gee, I wonder why. And look what happened to like Charles Lindbergh and the American First
Sure.
Committee. So this isn't anything new. If you even in the West, see right now, although we're kind of feeling, they've taken off the velvet glove, so to speak. We're feeling it kind of hard now with censorship. This isn't anything new because really in the past, if you represented serious opposition to the plans of those in power in Washington, D.C., and New York and London, whatever, they'd shut you down. And American First Committee, Charles Lindbergh, and they had ways of doing it. Look at Father Coughlin in the 1930s. He was deplatformed. The mail service wouldn't even deliver his newsletter. So that was something. But they've I guess again, actually they weren't publishing porn yet. But 20 years later, the U.S. Mail Service had no problem, mailing out Playboy and Penthouse, but they wouldn't mail out Father Coughlin's newsletter about, the intrigues
It's
of
the real
Washington,
one.
D.C. So that's it, nothing really new here, really. The difference was in recent years with technology, with the internet. I know this is said a lot, but there really was a leveling effect with the internet about 20, 15 years ago when it was highly democratized with YouTube and web, news getting on the net, that they were losing control of the narrative, which is why you're seeing now things like developments or terms like hate speech come up, and where protesting fraudulent or suspected fraudulent elections, electoral fraud, is now an insurrection, sedition. Actually, accusing people of sedition if you protest a questionable election. So,
I'm well aware of all of that.
I mean,
I
I'm sorry, you were at Charles Fair, weren't you?
was at, say that again.
Weren't you at Charlottesville in
I was at
2017?
Charlottesville. Yeah, I guess
I
it's
remember I
here.
talked to you right after that. Now, that's a good example of the regime simply not tolerating meaningful or opposition, meaning that there was a situation where those who were protesting, it was Take Back, it was Unite the Right rally. I think they met there to oppose the removal of Confederate statues like General Lee from Charlottesville. And they were there to give speeches to oppose. They'd gotten the permits and they were going to give speeches. And I guess other people were going to show up and give their speech. Now, you would think in a liberal democracy, such a permitted event would be allowed to go ahead and the authorities would protect it, meaning they'd protect counter-protesters who weren't permitted from going out and causing a riot. No, the exact opposite occurred. The city of Charlottesville, the state of Virginia, conspired to create a riot situation, endanger people. Then they go after and they prosecute a handful of the participants. And then there's also lawfare where the legal system is weaponized against the participants. These were the victims. These were the victims of Antifa, who the police and the state government actually. And then I'm thinking about as far back as 2007, as recent as 2007, how naive I was about these things. But this was in league with the government, and they worked with the they let them come in and disrupt that event and create a riot. Then they spin it into this horrible, right wing Nazis showed up, and to this day people are being prosecuted.
Yes, absolutely.
But.
It's a complete fiasco and a travesty.
That was just simply a planned protest to removal of statues that had been there for a century.
Absolutely. And I was there, I saw it all, and it was in some ways Charlottesville was like a dress rehearsal for January 6th.
Similar thing, and again, go back to that narrative is spun, but no basis in reality. Yet people are prosecuted on those false narratives. As you see in January, over 1,100 people with January 6th. Recently, I think Breitbart News, or was it Breitbart? Or was it the Gateway Pundit did a thing about the conditions of some of these people, how they've been treated and tortured so they can testify against people, complete abuse of power, and nary a word from the Republicans in the House, I mean, in the Congress, and no conservatives are speaking, but these are just people. These are like working class people who were foolish enough to show up and thought they had a right to protest, especially after what they saw the year prior with the BLM riots, the Antifa riots, right?
Exactly.
I mean,
It's just nuts. Now, I wanted to bring up one other thing since we're talking, and like before we end this conversation, because I'm interested in your insight on this particular issue, and it's something that's a lot more complex and that I'm still sort of trying to grapple with, and I don't exactly know the answer to. But you, when you wrote me about the Substack articles that had intrigued you, you included a list of several of them, and one of them was about the my article about Operation Paperclip. And let me just like it's a complicated thing, but let me just try to phrase it as best I can under the circumstances, which hopefully people will be interested in who haven't read it will be interested enough to go and read my article, because there I put it in a way that I'm sure is better than how I'm gonna struggle to put it here, because it is a complicated matter. But it happened when I was are you familiar with Jason Giorgiani?
The name is familiar.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, it's really not so important who he is, but he was a controversial figure. He's Iranian, but he was in some way affiliated with the alt-right at one time. And I don't, but in any case, he was talking. He gave this interview, and he was talking about Operation Paperclip and the significance of it. And it seemed as though what he was saying was that when the intelligence services of the United States brought all of these hardcore Nazis over and made them a part of the state apparatus in the United States, that they did not, their influence continued to be felt, and that they did not dissipate. They of course, you mentioned Wernher von Braun. He was the most conspicuous among them. He was the most famous among them, because he was affiliated with all the moon stuff, and rocket propulsion and things like that. But so they brought over these guys who were brilliant, but who were at least according to what I remember Giorgiani saying, heavily ideologized. It wasn't like they gave up their ideology and became, ardent believers in Americanism. They came over, but they still believed what they had believed, when they were in Germany. And it just made me that, like, this interview and other things that I had seen and heard made me think about the rise of political correctness. We know what now is called wokeism or SJWism or whatever. It's gone by many names, but I remember that political correctness was never a thing. It never truly, I mean, there was always liberalism. There were always, people on the left who would nag about, things, or call you a racist, or if you said something that they didn't like, or whatever. But it was never really that significant of a force until the early 90s. And I don't know if you have the same kind of memory. I think, like I said, we're about the same age. I don't know if you remember it about the same way, but it seems to me that, like, it was 90, 91, 92, 93 that we first started hearing about political correctness. And before that, all the time, and so let me finish my thought on that. Like, 91, 92, 93, this is the end of the Cold War. All right, the Cold War just ended. I guess some would say it ended in 89, the Berlin Wall came down and all of that, but I guess technically, the Soviet Union was dissolved in what, 91. So it kind of hung on in some form or other, but it just wasn't the force that it had been for, 70 years before that. But anyway, it was only in the early 90s that political correctness started, that we started to see this, like, we started to see people, like, it started to gain this kind of institutional momentum where, this anti-white perspective, or this anti-male perspective, or, saying, being down on you if you're a white male, or making fun of neighborhoods if they're too white, and making fun of white people for, I don't know, for this, that, or the other thing, and then that just being kind of like the dominant, the growingly dominant ideology. That wasn't even like, I'm remembering the 70s. I was born in 71, so I was a teenager in the 80s, and I remember in the 80s, there were like all kinds of shows, TV shows, that had all white families. There were no gay storylines ever. The commercials, if they showed a couple, it was a white couple, or sometimes it might be a black couple, but there was never a mixed race couple, hardly ever. And so it seemed like at the time, like up until the end, up until the Cold War ended, it seemed like, here's my thesis, it seems like the elite were on the side, or maybe not, I don't think they were on the side of Middle America per se, but they were signaling, they were okay with signaling positively towards, Middle America, mainstream America, white America, and putting forth these generally wholesome, as I said, sitcoms, like Family Ties, and I don't know, Growing Pains, and like they were corny and all, but that was part of the point. I mean, there were it was just wholesome white families, and nobody said like, oh, this is so, this is so racist. Why isn't there a single black character? Why isn't there a single non-white character in any of these? Like when Star Wars came out in 77, and the entire cast was white. Nobody said, oh, this is just such a travesty that there's no non-white characters anywhere. So it seems like in popular culture, up through the end of the Cold War, the elite were sort of pushing this idea that, we're with you, common American. We're fighting a common cause, and then once the Cold War ended, and once communism fell in the East, then that all went away. And starting in the 90s, not it, it it I mean it was nowhere near what it is today, but like it was starting up in 90, 92, 93, 94, 95. You would have more and more kind of institutionally sponsored hostility towards Middle America, towards white America. And then eventually, it took decades, but it eventually got to the point where it is today, and where it's been, for the last 5, 6, 7 years, where now, if you see a couple depicted in a commercial, they're either a gay couple or a mixed race couple, and you see just open hostility towards traditional mores, and open hostility towards middle American kind of, I don't know, values and principles, and just this push to gayify everything, and transify everything, and like this is the culmination of it now. But like this whole thing started in the 90s, and I'm just wondering, I mean, when I saw this thing with when I saw this interview with Jason Giorgiani and he was talking about this, he was talking about Operation Paperclip. It made me wonder, like, and here's the thesis that I put forth in my article. You know, and again, this is speculation, but you can tell me what you think of it. Like, okay, if America brought over these, you know, hardcore National Socialist types, you know, and they really entrenched themselves within, you know, the elite, within the establishment, of the United States. Well, they would be allied with America in hatred of you know, Bolshevism, of the Soviet Union, of communism. So it would make sense that as long as the Cold War was going on, they would be that they would be on the side of, you know, of saying, you know, because America was opposed to America and the West was opposed to the Soviet Union, and Nazi Germany was opposed to the Soviet Union and what, you know, what they called regarded as Jewish Bolshevism and so forth. But then after the fall of communism, then it's like, I'm wondering if like this part of the elite, you know, now saw it as the opportunity to try to basically to attack the host that they had been living off of, and that they had been supportive of for their own reasons because America was opposed to communism. But now that communism is over, now it was time for America and the West to be undermined. So, I mean, what do you think about that? I know it's a kind of complicated, convoluted notion, but what do you think?
Well, the Cold War perhaps kept people serious about things like the military and defense, meaning at a certain level, people actually interpreted the Soviet Union as a serious adversary threat to the survival of the United States. So they had to be somewhat serious about maintaining a resilient quality military.
Yes, and
That's why
that's why
you.
they didn't mess around with gays in the military. It
Yeah,
was like,
that's why, you
well,
know.
we need an effective military. So no, if you're a homosexual, you're not welcome.
Yeah, so the military, you know, even Hollywood movies like Top Gun, would act as a recruiting vehicle for the military, and they would portray being the
May have
military,
had
being
a, which may have had a homoerotic kind
well,
of
there's a joke about that. Yeah,
sense,
we all joke about
yeah.
that. But the message, you know, Reaganism and Top Gun, and at least
I
the
know,
military was
absolutely.
cool, and you could be like Tom Cruise and get the beautiful, the blonde chick who also teaches physics, right? You all know how pretty blondes love physics, you know, right? Now, yeah, it's like, who wants to join the military? So what? So you can, you know, be a tranny? So
Yeah, right.
you know,
Yeah, I mean.
Nate what was that Navy ad where he's like a sailor by day, you know, tranny by night or something? This is a recruiting vehicle for the military. So,
Another winner of a recruitment commercial.
and we, Chris, as you can see in the results, I don't think, except for the Marines, who aren't doing any of this, that everyone's like 30, 40% below their recruiting
Yeah.
quota or something. No one wants to go fight for the global American empire, global
No.
homo. Who wants to do this? At least, particularly, you know, white males
Yeah.
who would, from the
What's
South
it?
and
What is
Midwest,
for us? Nothing.
would fill the ranks, you know.
Yeah.
So yeah, so you have that. I think the end of the Cold War and things, it just without a serious adversary, people just got, you know, insane and goofy with all the money and all that. So, and also use the military, which is
Yeah.
always, you know, a laboratory for social engineering, but you use it in ways that we never thought, you know, reasonable or possible, like promoting homosexuality and transgenderism, whatever. So there's that. You have the long march to the institutions. You're talking about sort of things appear to accelerate, and that's what happens. I think it was where does Hemingway, who's in one of his book, was it, or was it in F. Scott Fitzgerald? I forget. How did you go bankrupt? First, very slowly, then all at once, right? Same thing with moral bankruptcy. As you start to, things go fast as you circle the drain, and that's just that. As the system collapses, that again, you have as the demographics of the country changes, and that was done intentionally. That's been intentional since the mid 1960s. So you have a qualitative change in who Americans are, the destruction or the assault out of its heritage core population, ethnic white population, which forms the American identity and its institutions, which define America. And we find that, of course, if you flood the country with people who have no identity or no history with the country, they're not going to respect its institutions. It's going to change, the culture and also the political institutions of the country. We're seeing that now with, lack of, and also if you don't promote these civic virtues, if you don't teach things like free speech, the First Amendment, the Bill of Rights to students, if you don't teach these things in the schools, they don't understand them or appreciate them. This is why now, supposedly Zoomers and millennials have very little regard for things like freedom of speech. Well, you're not teaching them and you're not promoting them. And then you're also promoting sort of a narcissism, solipsism, where people need safe spaces, where teach people that things like language is violence or something, where violence is language or violence is
Silence
speech.
is violence.
Yeah, silence is violence, but violence could be speech if you're a BLM or Antifa protester.
Yes, of
So
course.
you have the, we can point out the hypocrisies, but that's just all part of the
Yeah.
political game, which is sheer power politics. They don't
Yes.
care. The cultural
Damn it.
changes, what you suggest is, does this bespeak some sort of infiltration or
Yeah, that's what I'm wondering. I'm just,
I don't
I
think it's I don't think Operation Paperclip, I don't think it's a secret Nazi cell. You hear these stories like after during in
Yeah.
the latter stages of the war, like in 1944, you had the Bormann Capital Flight. The Red House meet, the Red Mansion, the Maison Rouge meeting, the Red Mansion meeting, where Martin Bormann met with these Nazi leaders, and they realized that the war was over after in July 1944, when they failed to prevent the Allied breakout out of Normandy, and they started to plan a post-war environment where all these Nazi finances and patents would be sent overseas to establish an international Nazi network infiltrated throughout South America. That's kind of lurid, and that's something it's kind of interesting. And the more I look into it, the more the less real it seems. The reality is that the operate a lot of these scientists who really weren't ideological Nazis. They were just scientists working for their government. Were integrated into the Western intelligence agencies and spy agencies and in science and space programs and these things, the military establishment, and they formed the Western Alliance against the Soviet Union as the Cold War developed in the late 1940s. As a sort of a practical response, I don't think it represented. Now, one thing is, Nazis would have despised Judeo-Bolshevism, particularly cultural Bolshevism. In fact, one of the
Yeah.
reasons why you had the rise of Nazism in the 30s in Germany was a response to Weimar, and so the degeneracy that was promoted by the Jews in Weimar in the 20s in Germany. And you saw that was dramatized in Cabaret, right? But that's a response. So if anything, you would think if there was a secret Nazi cell, there'd be culturally conservative, if not authoritarian, according to like the American Jewish Committee, where actually cultural conservatism and respect for authority leads to national social, leads to Hitler. So you have to promote degeneracy and chaos, and so I think
Well,
the agents of chaos aren't a Nazi cell. I think ultimately the agents of chaos in the West in the latter half of the 20th century can be traced along with the ascendancy or rise of Jewish power in the Western United States, largely based on the Holocaust narrative, and also using their already formidable power in media in entertainment and finance, and then sort of that being solidified in the 80s and 90s, that with the end of the Cold War, then you had this cultural, this sort of this cultural degeneracy being pushed, being sped up. Its antecedents, or its history goes further back, because you go back in the early 1970s, TV started to turn this way with like All in the Family. Sure. And these entertainments, and they gradually started promoting homosexuality. In the 80s, homosexuality was primarily promoted on TV through AIDS awareness. Everyone's right. Remember a very special episode. There's all these very special episodes of Family Ties, and it shows sure. where there's always a show about AIDS. And, and of course, it wasn't a cautionary tale against gay lifestyle. It's about tolerating homosexuals, oddly enough. never seemed to make any sense.
there were little things here and there, yeah. like that. I don't think it was it wasn't so ubiquitous as it became. It was
yeah.
barely. In fact, it was almost barely there, and it was like.
Well, the demographics changed. Got various. This is the sort of the culmination of years of flooding the country and diluting its ethnic white Christian majority. Emphasize ethnic white Christian because that's. Who they see as the adversaries. Then with the declining white majority, that with the, remember, the even going back as the 60s, the racial narrative of the civil rights movement was evil white people and noble victimized blacks or people of color or adjacent people of color or whatever. And that eventually that type of narrative was expanded to women with the promotion of feminism and with homosexuals with the promotion of gay rights, all of which were promoted by Jewish Jews in the media and academia and corporations and these things. That speaks to the strategy of Wilhelm Reich and also Herbert Marcuse and Eros and Civilization, and also the authoritarian personality of the American Jewish Committee, where you promote degeneracy to lead to depopulation, erosion of the family, and the demise of community, which creates an atomized society, which is easier to manipulate. And from their perspective, and they I mean, I'm just quoting what they write. They say that such a society where you have cohesive communities, ethnically homogenous communities, culture, high trust society, this is the seabed of fascism and Nazism. Now, this is a false claim because the Jewish strategy to promote degeneracy predates Hitler. It goes, it can go back as far back as the 1920 Hungary. So this is, again, it's them just using Hitler as an excuse for their promoting degeneracy because they see it as a way to make society easier to control. That's why they promote pornography. That's why the Israelis, when they rolled into Ramallah in 2004, they started broadcasting free pornography on the television to beguile the Palestinians, keep them, to preoccupy them. Now, the narrative is that pornography is an aspect of sexual liberation. That's freedom. Well, no, it's not freedom. What they're doing is they're enslaving you to your passions. They're manipulating you. That's what they do with advertising. And that, again, and of course, modern advertising is Edward Bernays and manipulation. And you could say that modern journalism, Edward Bernays is Jewish, of course, Sigmund Freud's nephew, and Walter Lippmann, another Jew who worked for the Wilson administration, spreading propaganda, who thought that the craft of journalism should be used to manipulate and control public opinion. Because his idea, and he's essentially correct, is public opinion doesn't really exist, it's created. And with the advent of modern technology, like radio, electronic media, these things, media, cinema, these things are within the... those who control that those platforms or those networks or studios have the ability to shape the culture, and if their motives are less than friendly, if they're malicious and they don't have a best interest at heart, then they can do a lot of damage in the process. Evidently, they have,
Yeah.
So that's, I think that's what we've seen in the past 30, 40 years. As the demographics changed, and then they have to be less concerned about public sensibilities because the past 30, 40, 50 years have been used corrupting and perverting public sensibilities. Easing the public acceptance of homosexuality, of sex, and these things, I mean, the coarsening of culture, these things, so it makes the public more malleable, less resistant. And as the public becomes less resistant, less organized, and lacking the agency, the political agency, and this is done psychologically, not just in political representation, but the idea that ethnic white people can't even respond as a group or perceived to have any interest is a psychological decapitation that's occurred. Now, where white people don't even have any collective interest. I heard it was what's his name, a comedian talking about, oh, white people have the privilege of not having to belong to any group. Now, how does that work in a multi-ethnic democracy? It means you'd be picked off one by one, practically speaking. If you don't have a group to represent you, then you have no power. You have no political agency, which is how, although white people represent more than 60% of the population, probably actual citizens, probably closer to still 2/3, they have no really meaningful representation or agency because we're the fall guys, we're the victims, we're blamed for everything. I saw a video today of they have, I don't know if this was set up, I'm going to assume it's genuine, but they have a room full of black people and they say, if you're proud of being black, move to the right. And they all move to the right, of course, because that's the, you know, this is that's the it's the zeitgeist of the day. Everyone's proud to be black. Yeah, black power, man. Then they have same group. Then they have another group of white people. So, are you, if you're proud to be white, move to the right. And only a couple move to the right. A couple stay in the middle. Most stay where they are. And they say, well, can I move a little bit? Because I'm not really proud of being white. I'm proud of what I have achieved. So there's no collective identity, but they're guilty. And this one girl says, "Well, I'm glad that I'm white because I'm not oppressed." But,
Well, yeah, I mean,
well, you are oppressed because look how you're apologizing for being white.
Yeah,
So you're psychologically oppressed. You're decapitated.
They're
Yeah.
brainwashed,
So
basically,
now
right?
they've been. So my point is, in the past, they had to consider public sensibilities and sheer mass because of the demographics. So they had to tread lightly and do it gently and gradually, and it gradually erodes. You know, a big ship starts to sink. The list is very mild at the beginning. Then there's a tipping point, as they say.
But the thing is, like, the black and the brown people, especially it's more brown people
Yeah.
that they're importing today, are they really crazy about gay and trans stuff? Are all the Muslims and
No, but they don't have agency, and I guess those that are doing it, the people who control, like Mayorkas at the Department of Homeland Security, who's literally conspiring to undermine the American government, I mean, our sovereignty. Our government, again, is our most treasonous institution at this point. That's one thing Americans have to understand is that is that those coming in are going to swamp the country, and they're not going to have any. They're not going to have the same political agency or standards that say the healthy, ethnically white middle class had in the United States. So at that point, the government wouldn't even have to play lip service to certain things, even continue pretending that it respects people. I mean, the government never really did, because even in the 50s and 60s, it lied that lied through its teeth to the American people, got us into Vietnam. When America was 85% white, we America just walked into Vietnam without any opposition. And look at the Greatest Generation, World War II. They were buffaloed in World War II and World War I. So that's not a, it's not a guarantee that that the that 85% white majority middle class is going to keep the government honest and responsible. Evidently, it didn't. But it's going to have to maintain some standards, and it did provide the good life, and it did secure the blessings, at least it appeared to preserve the blessings of liberty, which mean a lot, I guess. Even window dressing means something from day-to-day life. But when it, as the country eroded, at least its ethnic, it's the values, they say America is a creole nation. It's a, it's a proposition nations, they say. It's made up of propositions. Well, the reality is that you look at those propositions or creeds that supposedly define America only have brought support upon its within its ethnically white majority. And if you do away that majority, those propositions aren't supported anymore, especially if you have immigration kept at a pace that it is. It just simply overwhelms, which I think now they're trying to do because there's a complete breakdown at the border.
Well, I mean, all those things are definitely happening that you're, I mean, I just find it peculiar that there was this abrupt turn, even with, like you say, there were aids, there were like very special episodes on designing women guys or whatever
There's awful like sitcoms, very special episodes,
in the 80s. There still wasn't
And
like
then, by the
nobody.
way, the gay people never look like gay people, so
Yeah, and no, and nobody, not even the gays talked, were saying we have a right to marry each other. Like in the 70s and 80s, that was just not as far as I was concerned, it wasn't even that wasn't a concept that even like the most radical
Oh, yeah, because gay
liberal
liberation was
activists.
about eschewing all that,
Yeah,
eschewing
and
the responsibilities of life and, living, basically spending your
they
life
saw
in a gay disco going round and round going nowhere. Yeah.
they saw themselves as different, like that they were going to live apart and do their own thing, and like I don't know, but it was so I don't know, this is like, and admittedly it's a lot, it's speculation, but
Well, because as long as the gay, sort of the ghetto gay, it was ghettoized, marginalized, it posed little or no threat to the general public. But if you can weaponize it the same way, similar ways that the blacks were weaponized by the Jews in the country to mobilize the civil rights movement, was to take a perceived, whether a real or perceived, a grievance and weaponize it. And they don't use it to find, and don't use it to come to some sort of resolution, some sort of amicable or your equity, if I can use that word, I know, equitable solution, if you will, to the problem. It's there to exasperate the problem, to recognize those fault lines in society and make them worse, to weaken it. And that's what the Jews did with the civil rights movement, with the black. For example, someone's. Looking back at the past 60 years, I'm saying, I'm so glad they passed the Civil Rights Law, Civil Rights Act, because, to, because now we have a post-racial society.
right. Wish.
Yeah, but the moment they pass the laws, they start imposing things like affirmative action and disparate
Yeah.
impact, and because they're coming against the reality that not all people are equal, not all groups are equal. They're very different, and they're going to achieve differently and live different lives, different cultures, which theoretically should be fine if you respect boundaries and don't engage in social engineering. But they didn't do that. They engaged in the busing, and they tried to equalize everything and pretend that was an achievable, even a desirable outcome. I don't think it's a desirable outcome, because you destroy real freedom in that case. Often these things are just reflect our own taste and our own priorities, our own values. But they have demonstrable or tangible results in life, meaning whether it's income or academic achievement. But then the way that current law treats it, they look at any disparity as a prima facie case of racial discrimination, when that's not the case. There are group differences.
Yes.
And we
Well,
see that today with the current competency crisis, where they're trying to push diversity and representation, something, whether it's the FAA or medical schools or law schools or public safety and such, public safety agencies, where you complete breakdown in competence. And everywhere you look, you see breakdown of incompetence, whether it's water not being able to be provided, potable clean water, or electricity, power grids not being maintained. You see diversity. South Africa today, look at it. Hey, it's no longer racist, but they don't have a reliable power grid anymore, and 85, 90% of the children there are illiterate. Well,
It's pretty racist. I think the white farmers would say that it's pretty racist.
that's true, but then that go back to narratives. I heard someone say that, well, it's fair because they stole the farms. No, they didn't. They created the farm. You read history about South Africa. There was no agriculture in South Africa before the Dutch farmers showed up. And they turn it into a breadbasket through hard work and ingenuity. It's something that the natives couldn't do. In fact, there weren't natives. From what I understand, the area had been cleared out anyway, through largely by the Zulus, the war there. But again, that's the importance of narrative. We just saw it as white people being mean to black people. That's how it was portrayed in the West. But no one ever thought to think, or at least when the question was asked, was okay. If you do away with the apartheid system, you do away with the apartheid government, how is this country going to function? It didn't matter. What mattered was getting rid of that system, because under the racial narrative of the civil rights movement, that itself was evil in and of itself, n never justified, no practical reasons for it. There was no justified reason for Afrikaner culture or white culture to defend itself in that area. You simply had to desegregate, do away with all, barriers and these things, and then have a what they call a rainbow nation. Well, look at it. But the good news is it's they are close to meeting their emission stand the mission goals, zero carbon, because the entire economy's collapsed, so they have just almost no carbon emissions anymore in South Africa.
They've become a pastoral nation, basically. They've
Yeah. Which might give us an indication what what Davos had have in store for the rest of the world. So, I don't
So,
know. I mean, did I shed any the
well,
question you asked me?
I get what you're saying. I
Yeah.
mean, but I don't think, I think the undoubtedly demographics have changed over the last 30 years. I don't, to me, that doesn't explain why there was this sudden shift in like up through about 1989, like these kind of politically correct notions, could would did not get any oxygen. Like from, I mean, they were out there. There were people pushing these kinds of ideas, but it seemed like it was only after, it was only in the early 90s that we started to hear about, like, oh, well, they're this they're they're pushing this idea. They're pushing this. They're pushing that. They're
Well, I think it's the end stage liberalism. I think you touched on in the article. You say, of course, liberalism existed and it was devoutly followed by many in the West in one form or another for decades, indeed for centuries. And numerous ideologies now largely associated with political correctness or wokeness, as it now called, originated from liberalism. Feminism, gay rights, sexual liberation, anti-racism, and so forth. And naturally, I do not deny that the upheaval of the 60s significantly altered the cultural landscape of the Western world. Certain pernicious trends, beginning with the introduction of birth control pill, were relentlessly pushed on the populace with undeniable support from high places, resulting in increasingly degenerate societal conditions. So, I think you're answering your own question right there. What happens is there is a the sort of the dissolving of the values, the hierarchies, the illiberal institutions that make liberalism possible. This is the support system for liberalism, as that foundation was eroded intentionally by the things you said, it collapses, and that's what's happening now. So it's it, you're it's a progressive collapse, and I don't see it as necessarily as a sort of a reverse Whig history or inevitable collapse or doomism or something you might see like in The Course of Civilization, like in Thomas Cole's famous paintings, where you have the savage state, the Arcadian, the agrarian state, the consummation of empire, then you have destruction and desolation. There's sort of a natural. Now you can look at a broader aspect. You look at the civilization as sort of a lifespan of a man, where it develops, grows into the prime, then decays. Interesting enough, the Soviet Union lasted about 75 years, which is kind of the lifespan of an individual, of a man. The West, well, if you look at 1950, the peak, right, after World War II, 75 years, we're getting 2025, we might be close to that as well, if you pick 1950 as the date, or 1949 about. So when you're getting there, but I think in that piece you wrote about this, I think you're kind of answering your own question here. And I don't think that, now, although there's enough emergent behavior that occurs with this stuff, meaning there's nudge theory, as you say, Cass Sunstein says, nudge, if you nudge things in a certain direction, you can, there's enough emergent behavior, especially if you're in a position with control of money and corporations like BlackRock promoting wokeism, you can connect the dots. If you're in control of these nodes, these key areas of society, finance is big. Then you can control entertainment and media and even religion. Then what happens is then you can push in that direction. I think that's what we're seeing. With something like transgenderism, which you can connect the dots, draw a schematic, and of a few families of a certain persuasion that are pushing this hard, financing it. Same with feminism, same with abortion.
Speaking of transgenderism, that's that like the I guess this is, I'll just point this out quickly because it was in another article that you highlighted. Like there's no logical sense to what they're doing. I mean, they want us to maintain, like there's this double think effort where, like with transgenderism, well, with with radical feminism, they pushed the idea that there's no such thing as biologically being there's no such thing as biologically derived male or female behavior or masculine or feminine behavior. It's all, you know, socially conditioned. So mm-hmm. you could take a group of men, if you raise them from, you know, toddlerhood up and taught them and trained them to be feminine, that men would be feminine and women would learn to be masculine, but they're just, it's just cultural conditioning that's making people masculine and feminine. And then they come along and say, well, actually, you have people living in male bodies, but they're actually female in their essence. And it's like, wait a minute, you were saying just a minute ago that there is no such thing as being male or female at your essence. It's all socially conditioned, right? Mm-hmm. But now they're saying, no, it's different. This is different because we want to promote transgenderism, which directly goes against this idea of gender being, you know, culturally conditioned and having no derivation in biology. Now they're saying, you know, you have people who are, you know, whose souls, if you will, are female, but they're stuck in male bodies, or their souls are male, but they're stuck in female bodies, or they're neither male nor female, but they're stuck in a male body or a female. I was going to say bipolar, but
yeah, they're assigned birth.
Yeah,
assigned a sex at birth, rather.
Yeah. It called when you say you're neither male nor female?
Non-binary.
Non-binary. Yeah, that's right. These ideas that they push, they're not. I mean, they're you can easily see how self-contradictory they are, but nobody talks about it. Nobody, you know, people, if you point it out, it doesn't get highlighted, and nobody else. It's not like, it's like they're just brought. It's like if somebody out there was just saying, oh, well, 2 + 2 can equal 4, but it can also equal 5, and sometimes it equals 6.
Well, which is, I think that's the end game right there, isn't it? Meaning truth is the opinion of the powerful. So you're imposing logic on them, and that is something the party doesn't tolerate. And they don't want you to say 2 + 2 = 4, because that way there's truth and there's limits to their power. If the truth, if there is no truth, and truth simply becomes, you know, their what they say, then they control things, and they can say everyone has their own truth, but only a few men or people have the ability to impose their truth, and then they become the overlords as a practical matter.
Yes, you know? Right.
C.S. Lewis in The Abolition of Man said something to the effect that the ability to transform man isn't the power for all people to transform themselves. It's the ability of some men to impose the transformation on others.
Mm.
And I know I'm butchering that, but something that affects, again, it's, again, the truth becomes the opinion of the powerful. So when you point out this inconsistency or logic, they don't care.
Yeah.
They got the power to impose it. At least they think they do.
Right.
You know, and so that's why you have, you know, that's why you have cancel culture and deplatforming and chanting trans women are women, blah, 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 so that they can some sort of incantation or slogan make it so. And they can't, of course, but they've gone mad. You know.
Yes.
But I think that's why you're saying, you're looking at, so you're thinking like a white male. And from what I understand, according to the African American Museum, logic is an attribute of white supremacy. So
I don't doubt that they would say that. I don't think that, like, but I mean, like, think of the earliest black, like, you know, intellectual pioneers who actually had to make it in the white man's world and who were actually, you know, smart and mm-hmm. you know, actually thought that intellect and was and reason were good things. I mean, like that, like just that's just such that's like I'm somebody like Thomas Sowell, like for example, like an author that I admire who's black, like that's just such an insult to say logic is the province of the white male, like or that's like giving people like you and me such a compliment and insult and paying such an insult to everybody else. But of course they don't see it that they see it as like, oh, gross, what, you know, logic and reason, and that's just but anyway, it's just upside down and inside out. It's ridiculous, but we knew that already.
So that's a good way to end it, I think.
Sure. Anything else you wanted to
No, that's
cut?
good. I think that's the kind of conversation I anticipated. I wonder after I post this if it's going to make any sense, but that's okay. I mean,
Yeah. Yeah.
I'd be hard pressed to find a title for
I'll think it over, and if something occurs to me, I'll just send it to you.
Well, I think whenever I'm in the mood for a meandering, nonsensical conversation, I think of Andy.
Well,
But that's
thanks.
it's a conversation. No, it's that's a conversation because you're doing the articles. But I think if people sit back and listen to this and also read the articles, I think you understand what we're getting at here.
Yes. Good. Good. So should are we still on here, or is it
No, I
like
haven't
are
cut off
you?
yet. I'm about to.
Okay. All right.
So, do you want to say something
So yeah,
afterwards?
so
Okay, well, I'll let you
just
go. Plug your work.
okay. Well, as I said, you can find I've written fiction and nonfiction. You can find it on my Amazon page. My Substack page is andynowicki.substack.com. I have a YouTube channel, which is just my name. You can find my stuff there. You can see me there talking about this, that, and the other thing, sort of thing. I don't have any recent project to hawk at the moment, although I'm anticipating publishing something new with Terror House Press, which is they're the ones who've published my last I think four or five books, so and they're an excellent company, if I can say that, not just because they publish me, but because they publish a lot of great stuff. So you can find me there at terrorhousepress.com. Yeah, that's about it. Just enter my name in a search engine, and if you do it on Bing, the first thing that'll come up is the ADL article which mentions me. I just found that out today. On Google, it's like, you have to scroll down a little till you get to that article, but if it's on Bing, the Bing.com, then type in Andy Nowicki, and the first thing that comes up is I'm on the ADL naughty list, which was published like 6 years ago, but it's definitely a feather in my cap. It's something I take as
That's right.
as a badge of honor. So.
Yes, that's
To be
it.
on the ADL naughty list.
Your bona fides. You're up there with
That's absolutely up
some of
there
the
with the
great, some of
greats.
the
Absolutely.
Okay. Thank you so much,
Right.
Andy.
Well, yeah, enjoyed the conversation.
Good night then. Take it easy. Bye-bye.
Bye.